The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I'm your host, Soraya. And this is Where Did the Road Go? And a couple things to note. As of tomorrow, you'll be able to hear a replay of this show on Art Bell's Dark Matter Radio Network at artbell.com. And you can hear older shows replayed on Deprogrammed Radio. You can find the link for that. I think it's just deprogrammedradio.com. And you can find that at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can access all the old shows. And if you want, you can come into the chat room tonight, and if you have any questions for our guest. And our guest tonight is Aaron John Gullius. And am I saying your last name right, Aaron?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. And you've written a bunch of books. Your latest is called The Chaos Conundrum. And the subtitle is Essays on UFOs, Ghosts, and Other High Strangeness in Our Non-Rational and Atemporal World. And it's a great read. It's not excessively long, but it seems actually just right.
Yeah, the length was sort of, I sort of said what I needed to say and then stopped. And so it turned out shorter than I was expecting it to be, but longer than I hoped, considering what I set out to do. So I think it's a good length.
It really is. It's like a perfect length. You wrap it up from beginning to end so beautifully. Let's get into a little bit of your history. You're a teacher, right?
Yes.
Okay. And what do you teach?
I teach U.S. and world history at Mott Community College in Flint, Michigan.
Okay. And you've written some books on that type of topic, right?
The first book I wrote, Extraterrestrials in the American Zeitgeist, was for McFarland Books, came out back in May, and it sort of straddles the line between flying saucer sorts of things and academic history and cultural studies. It's mostly about the contactee phenomenon from the 1950s up through its sort of modern day descendants and sort of spin-offs. And as far as other writing I've done, not books, but other things, I've done a lot with basically history, educational materials, articles, things like that.
And what's your connection with Doctor Who?
Oh, that that book. That was weird. I've written a chapter contributed a chapter to a scholarly book of essays about Doctor Who that came out earlier this year. And I really enjoyed writing about Doctor Who. I'd been a fan since about 1991 or so when I was in high school and discovered the show. And I was invited to be a guest at a Doctor Who convention in Toronto about a month and a half ago. And I realized that the only thing I had to tell people to buy of mine was this book that I had the essay in that I don't actually make any money off of. So I figured I better write a book so, you know, they can buy it and pay me. So I wrote a short, little shorter than Chaos Conundrum, cheap, short, little sort of Doctor Who fan autobiography analysis sort of thing, fitting Doctor Who into the context of being a fan in the United States rather than the traditional British fan. So it's a weird little funky thing, more of a long fanzine or a short book than anything else.
Interesting. And when I was reading your Chaos Conundrum, your latest book, one of the first things you'd get into is, what was the exact word? Archaeoacoustics.
Archaeoacoustics, yes. That is something that is technically still categorized as a pseudoscience. It's not really provable, but the idea is, and I've read about this idea quite a bit, is if you flood spaces with certain frequencies, I think that the technical name is pink noise rather than white noise or gray noise or anything like that, but pink noise spectrum, you can basically hear echoes of sounds that existed long ago. It's sort of a weird, funky thing that is very sort of not proven or actually not very provable in sort of a consistent, repeatable super scientific way.
Well, not yet, anyway.
Not yet. Yeah, I think probably in the future we'll be able to do this. But there's this idea that sounds, that voices, that human activity or any sort of activity, sort of gets etched into the landscape or etched into buildings in a way, and that we might be able to suck those things out of it, sort of a audio carbon dating sort of process. It's hard to explain, but it appealed to me, not just as somebody who thinks that it could be a great sort of, not if not explanation, but one of many possible explanations for ghosts, hauntings, things like that. But also as a historian, I think one of the examples I use in the book, or if not, it's a good one, is, you know, having some sort of record of the debates around the U.S. Constitutional Convention in the late 1780s there in Philadelphia. It would be amazing to hear what was actually said and compare it to what people said was said, which might not be the same thing.
Probably not. But didn't they actually do something like that on Doctor Who, or am I thinking of something else where he used the sonic screwdriver to pull some sound out of something?
Yeah, there was. I can't remember exactly the episode it was, but I remember that scene where the little squealy sound of the sonic screwdriver, and then it sort of bounces back, sort of echoing with voices and sounds.
Yeah, like it had recorded in the actual landscape, as you say.
Right.
And it's also kind of a version of the stone tape theory as well.
Right, exactly.
What do you now you started out, when you started doing this as a teenager and stuff and got into the unexplained and the paranormal, how young were you when you found this stuff interesting?
It's such a cliche. I was always interested, Soraya, from the womb, right? But mostly what really sort of piqued my interest when I was a little kid, maybe 5-6 years old, on Saturday afternoons, our local, you know, syndicated TV station would play old episodes of In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. And that just freaked me out. I recently bought a bunch of them on DVD and was freaked out again. There's something about the way they're filmed, Nimoy's narration, the way they tell the stories, that not knowing anything about these topics, being a little kid, I found it deeply unsettling. And from there, I got into some of these books that were written for kids, World's Most Famous Ghosts and things like that. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And then in high school, I discovered flying saucer-type things almost simultaneously with The X-Files beginning in 1993, sort of when I was getting ready to go off to college and have access to the internet, or what passed for the internet in 1993, which was mostly Usenet and Gopher, if you remember those things. So I was hanging around on Alt-Alien Visitors and the Paranet discussion boards and reading all of these theories and all of these text documents that you can still find out there on the internet that explained everything and tied it all together and brought in John Lear's ideas and the Matrix documents by Val Valerian, whose real name I think was John Grace, if I'm not mistaken, and then Bill Cooper, of course.
Yeah, so we'll get to him in a bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I just fell into this stuff, and I believed that I for a while there, I believed just about everything I read. Terrible critical thinking and you know, a little more scrutiny sort of scared me off that, you know, believing anything that was typed in a sort of typewriter courier font that had, you know, black marker over it and looked official. So, you know, once I realized how easy it was really to fake some of these things. But it's been a long, long-term interest for me.
And just as an interesting aside, I actually do post this show on Usenet.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
I posted it in the Alt Binaries Paranormal group.
Oh, I actually have played around in there recently. So yeah, that's Usenet's great.
It really is. And most people don't know anything about it, despite the fact that it's older than the World Wide Web.
Yep, and it's still out there. Some of the more robust conversations, I think, have moved elsewhere for most topics. But if you go to the Alt Conspiracy group, there's still a lot of discussion taking place, and a lot of flame wars and the usual Usenet things. Yeah,
that's just internet things at
right.
this point.
Yeah, now it sort of moved out from there. Yeah.
Now, you have a chapter in here talking about your crop circle. And your experiences in general, but you had a few. You're very candid about the whole thing.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It was just a weird summer day in Northeast Indiana, and one day the newspaper said, you know, last night a crop circle appeared in a farm out in the middle of nowhere. So me and my buddy, we were like, well, let's dress like, you know, UFO investigator types, whatever we thought that might be. And I had a membership card from something called the UFO Investigation Agency, which I can't find any trace of now. And I was the head of strategic investigation team 1310, which consisted of just me. And so I had my fake little ID card, which I forgot to take with me to the crop circle. And it was a crop circle. It wasn't one of these super fancy decorative ones like you see on pictures, and especially over in Britain. But it was a large, probably 40 foot across, rough circle that looked like it had been sort of tramped down. And it was interesting, and there were very interesting people there, some people who thought it was absolutely real and others who thought it was real and it was frightening, and that me and my buddy were actually government agents coming to investigate him. One old guy who was just paranoid. He just kept looking at us. We were actually kind of scared. We had to try to convince him that we were absolutely nobody important and that we really didn't care that he knew the thing was real. We weren't the men in black. I was the man in tweed, which was bad because it was 90 degrees. It was like July. But, you know, UFO guys should run around in tweed jackets, so that's what I put on. Because I'm an idiot, right? So my friend was wearing like all black and then like a trench coat. It's like we looked like morons, but it was very fun. I think the book talks about we built a fake device out of an old slide projector, mm-hmm. and we called it the paranormal energy detector. And my buddy was like walking along the ditch, pointing this thing at it, and looking through the lens, and then yelling out numbers, which I would repeat into a tape recorder. That meant nothing. That meant absolutely nothing. And people were just very confused by us. Very, very confused by us. But it was an interesting experience talking to people who believed this to be an absolutely strange, out-of-the-normal event. And the wide variety of reactions they had, from awestruck wonder that the Space Brothers are communicating with us to paranoia that because he knows that it's real, we are going to lock him up, send him to the American concentration camps, or put him in a Walmart warehouse somewhere where he'll never escape, or do something to him. So it was an interesting sort of experiment. And it was also, looking back on it, a shamefully dorky thing to do.
Just, yes, you include all the dialogue between you and your friend.
It is horrifically realistic. As far as I remember it, that is exactly how we sounded. And we still do. We sort of lapse into this melodramatic dialogue whenever we talk. It's very strange.
Well, it was quite entertaining, to say the least. What do you think about crop circles?
I think there's, this is another cop-out answer. I think there's probably as many explanations for crop circles as there are crop circles. I don't think it's necessarily one thing causing them. I'm fairly sure that a majority of them are, I'm not going to say hoaxes. I don't think they're hoaxes. I think it's art. I think it's artistic expression that is tied into what we think they might be, messages, iconography, and whatever the purpose of the people creating them, I think they do have an artistic purpose. Now, there's some really interesting research that illustrates or suggests that there are some, you know, fundamental changes occurring to the crops, sort of plasma burns, blistering, things like that. So they're weird. I guess that's the best way I can say it. They're weird. I don't think they're... I remember when they first appeared, or when I first heard about them, one of the ideas was, well, that's where the flying saucers landed.
Right.
But that, I mean, if you look at the designs, it doesn't look like it's necessarily just a landing craft. And to call it a landing, or not a landing craft, a place where craft landed, and to call it that sort of assumes the whole flying saucer shape and configuration, which I'm not sure is an entirely safe thing to do. True. But I think some of them are, if not supernatural, then at least natural in a way that we're not entirely able to get a handle on yet.
You figure they the pre-crop circle were the saucer nests that appeared in various
right.
places in the world, hence why they got associated with landing spots. And when they're
right.
circles, and you have a flying saucer and it's a circle, but once the designs got more complicated, what I found interesting in reading Colin Andrews' new book, he's the guy who came up with the word crop circle, he no longer believes most of them are real.
Ah.
And that's a big turnaround for him. And I'm going to have him hopefully on next month to talk about
excellent.
It.
Oh, excellent.
And he honestly believes most of them are fake in the fact that, like you said, they're artistic. But apparently even the people who make these crop circles have had so many weird experiences. Sometimes they feel compelled to make certain designs and stuff, almost like they're communicating with something unseen.
That is I've heard that. I've heard people talk about that aspect of it, and I think that plays in very well with some of the other ways I think about these phenomena, that the actual manifestation of it, whether it's in the sky or in a wheat field, the actual manifestation that we experience is a symptom of whatever's going on rather than what is going on itself. I think Mac Toney's in his Crypto-Terrestrials book, I don't know if you've read that one, but he talks about how his cat really enjoyed chasing the laser pointer and sort of makes the comparison that whatever we see in the sky, that's like the laser. We're like the cats really paying attention to the laser and not really noticing or even caring that something might be behind that mirage that we're looking at. And I think the crop circles, this idea that they're the product of what people have felt compelled to do by forces they can't explain, I think that's actually a lot more fascinating to think about than a spaceship came down and made a design in a wheat field for, you know, no discernible reason, yeah. then left.
And you do get lights associated with them, but I've always been annoyed by that jump from lights to spaceship.
Right.
You know, it's like someone sees a light. Oh, it's an alien spacecraft. No, it's a light. And if you saw that same light inside of a house, then it becomes a ghost.
Right. Right.
I was just going to say something about that, though. The Mac Toney's. I actually was not familiar with him until I had read Paul Kimball's book, The Other Side of Truth. I'd never heard of him before, so I haven't read any of his stuff yet. Do you want to tell people a little bit about him? I know you're a big fan of his work.
Yeah. Mac Toney's was a writer and artist and thinker who dealt mainly in the topics of post-humanism, cyber culture, and Mars Anomalies. His first nonfiction book was called After the Martian Apocalypse and was a case for exploring these Mars anomalies. And he looked at them in a much more rational way than the sort of wild-eyed speculation and conspiracy of Richard Hoagland. So that was refreshing, but he moved away a bit from the Mars Anomalies, especially on his Post-Human Blues blog that he maintained throughout 2003, 2004, 2005, and on until his death in 2010, I believe. And he moved into the topics of looking at aliens and looking at the culture of it, and he came to not a conclusion, because he was moving, actually probably didn't believe the theory entirely himself, but as a thought experiment, as a possible way of looking at these alien contacts, introduced a concept that he called the crypto-terrestrials, the idea that there was an evolutionary offshoot of humanity that was hidden on the planet that we were interacting with, and that this might explain some, not all, but some alleged alien encounters, and would sort of address the idea that, for example, things like the abduction phenomenon and needing human genetic material and those sorts of tropes that go through these stories, these creatures act like humans. They act like they are treating us like lab animals. So they fit within our, in many ways, the same anthropological sort of bubble that we do. And so he thought about this this crypto-terrestrial notion as a way to possibly explain some alleged extraterrestrial encounters. I corresponded with him online. I never met him in person, but I started reading his blog back in 2006, 2007, along with Paul Kimball's, and then Greg Bishop's Project Beta book came out around the same time, and I started reading a lot of Nick Redfern's stuff. And really, that was the sort of core group of people who really got me more deeply into this topic than I had been in a long time.
Yeah, I plan on picking up some of Mac Tony's stuff at some point, because everything I've heard about him it sounds very unique.
He was an amazing thinker, and a cheap plug for Red Star Books, which published the Chaos Conundrum. In the next week or so, they're going to be releasing the second volume of the collected and edited and sort of bookified, and that's not a word, but bookified writings from Mac's blog, and it's going to be great. I wrote the introduction for the first volume last year, and it was a very different, very rewarding experience reading these things in printed form rather than in sort of the condensed, you know, full caffeinated version of Mac's ideas, rather than going back to his blog and paging through pages of, you know, links and photos and everything. So it's a great snapshot of weird fringe topics in the early 21st century, as much as it is a book about paranormal ideas, which was only a fraction of what Mac dealt with. It's a great snapshot of life in America in the early 21st century.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the idea that if we were to interact with another intelligence, a true alien intelligence, it might be so different we wouldn't even recognize we were doing it.
Yeah, I started to have this idea when I was thinking about language and how our language is something that is so much a part of us that we almost forget it's there. Language goes beyond the words we say and the words we read and the symbols that we interpret. We may speak English, Dutch, French, Spanish, whatever. The words in our minds usually fit into one standard language, the first one we learned usually. But everything in many ways revolves around language. Even people who are unable to speak or who are unable to hear function in a world of language. Words don't just describe the world around us. We give meaning to things with words, which is sort of going beyond describing. But if the people or the beings or the intelligences we may encounter out in the universe, if they somehow evolved or were created or emerged from whatever sort of place they emerged from as creatures or beings, not just who speak a different language or who communicate differently, but who have no language and maybe no communication at all. I mean, it sounds weird, and you might think, well, how would that even work? That isn't even possible. They're alien, you know? It might be so completely different that nothing makes sense to us in any way. And it might be so different that we don't even recognize it. And that's why I'm so amused at many of the theories and stories about aliens and alien encounters that pop up, because it's so clear that whether consciously or unconsciously, and I really am leery of labeling people hoaxers, because I think often what people describe speaks to some actual experience they had, and they're putting it in whatever framework they can. But they're also bound up in humanity. Even when we're dealing with creatures that aren't human, it's a very human-like experience, because we're interacting, we're communicating in some way, and we might sort of hedge our bets and say, well, it's telepathic communication, not verbal communication. But telepathy, you transmit ideas into a person's head. It may be an image that's placed in your head, but in some way, at some point in your brain, language takes hold, and you give a word to that image that's in your head. If the words aren't there, then that would be a very, very strange experience.
Yes, yes, it would. And I always, you know, for ages, I've always wondered, you know, they'll say, well, there's no life anywhere else in the solar system. And how do we know there's not some form of life deep in Jupiter that we just don't conceive of? I mean, look at the stuff we found on this planet that's living in these super hostile environments that we never expected to be able to, you know, invents of volcanoes or deep under the ice.
There are things that live at pressures and depths in this planet that we could not even imagine. And those things are alive. They're alive in a way that we can recognize.
Yeah.
And yet they're so much different than anything else that we might encounter. So how different might be life that we don't even think to look for? Because we assume nothing could live somewhere, so we aren't even paying attention.
The one thing about life is it seems to adapt to its environment, and it seems to be, as far as this planet is concerned, it's everywhere. So what makes this planet special? Why wouldn't it be everywhere just in general? There could be stuff living in the heart of the sun for all we know.
There could be. I don't think we can rule it out. I don't think we can assume that it's there, but I don't think we can assume it's not.
Right.
It's something that's open for exploration. And
our view of what is life is so narrow, and like what is conscious is so narrow that we just block everything else out as a possibility.
We interpret things according to our incredibly small frame of reference, and even if our frame of reference is humanity, or our frame of reference is organic life as it exists on the planet, that's a pretty broad range of types of life, as we've said. I mean, everything from human beings to coral, you know, is a form of life. Yeah. So if we were to leave this planet and be in an environment that is completely different in almost every way, we would find something that was life, but we wouldn't know possibly how to look for it in a way that was useful.
One of the things you talk about in the book, the very first chapter, you talk a little bit about ghost hunting, and that's when you get into the archaeoacoustics. But have you ever done any ghost hunting?
You know, I was supposed to. 2 weekends ago with the friends that I mentioned in the experiences chapter, but some stuff came up and I wasn't able to. I was bitterly disappointed. Mm. The closest I've got to actual ghost hunting is what I describe in chapter 2 of the book, when they take me to this supposedly haunted cemetery down in the depths of a national forest in southern Indiana. And there was supposed to be ghosts, and I didn't see anything that I would describe as a ghost, but I do recall that at the same identical moment, the three of us in this cemetery in the dark, it was late November, and so it was probably about 8-9 o'clock at night, so it was, you know, pitch black by that point. At one moment, we all just sort of looked at each other, and without saying a word, we just started running about a quarter mile back to where the car was parked down off the main highway. And it was a deeply unsettling experience. I didn't see anything strange. I didn't hear anything strange. But I'm not even comfortable saying I felt a presence. I didn't. I just felt like I had to get out of there. And whether that was my mind playing tricks on me, it very possibly could have been. It very probably could have been. But one thing that I say in the book, and that I always say, is somebody telling me that something is all in my head is not comforting in the slightest. Because, you know, if something makes me utterly anxious and terrified and I need to get out by running, which is something I don't really like doing a lot, you know, that's not great. I want it to be something outside, tangible, that I can explain and point to. The idea that something is utterly terrifying and damaging and only exists in my head and only I can experience it, nobody could possibly help me with it, I mean, that is horrifying. It's horrifying. So, I mean, part of me kind of hopes it was a, you know, spirit of some long-deceased pioneer girl, because otherwise something was... you know, going strange in my brain, and that's you know, deeply unsettling.
Well, it could have just been a field of energy you weren't consciously picking up, too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I remember John Keel, I think it was in the Mothman Prophecies, where he's sitting in the TNT area, and he says he hits a point where he can't move forward, and something there just is scaring the hell out of him, and he has no idea what it is. There's no, he's not seeing anything. He has no rational reason to be afraid. And I think he connected it to extra low frequency waves having that effect on people.
Yeah, I remember that part in Mothman Prophecies, and when I think I read Mothman after this experience, and that did resonate with me. And I looked around a little bit for anything in the area that might have caused those extra low or extremely low frequencies, and I don't think I found anything. I sort of dismissed it, but yeah, I actually connected to that. In haunted houses and extremely low frequencies, I just remembered this. Do you remember, I don't know what your age is or anything, but do you remember the Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators series of mystery books for kids?
Not offhand, no.
Okay, it was just a goofy little series from the 50s or 60s where, for some reason, these three teenagers were solving mysteries, and Alfred Hitchcock was supplying them with a limo and a driver because he wanted to hear about their mysteries they solved so he could steal their ideas from movies or something. It was a very strange series of books. But in one of them, there was a haunted house, and it turns out that the house wasn't haunted. What somebody was doing in a very Scooby-Doo-like way was scaring people off with, you know, a hoax that made people think the house was haunted. But what always stayed with me, and you know, this our conversation jogged my memory of this, is that the mechanism used to persuade people the house was haunted was an old pipe organ that was adjusted to play notes so low that the ear couldn't physically pick them up, but that the brain could detect. So extra low frequency pipe organ notes were the cause of this this haunting like anxiety. So it's definitely something that at least was in kids' books back in the day. Yeah.
I love graveyards. I love exploring old graveyards, and I've seen, you know, been in old ones, I've been in new ones. I've had a lot of weird experiences in some graveyards, and it's always the really old graveyards.
Yeah.
The newer graveyards, I've never had a weird experience in, and the more I thought about that, the more I realized that these older graveyards may very well have been picked. That location may have been picked because it was a sacred spot. Whereas newer graveyards are just picked because, oh, we have room there for a graveyard.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it, and it certainly connects to the idea, sort of historically, that holy sites tend to be recycled over time. Pagan spots are repurposed to Christian churches, are repurposed to mosques. You know, the Ottoman Empire comes in and churches are converted to mosques and things like that, and then back again and back again and back and forth and back and forth. But the idea is going back is perhaps at some point before any of these things existed, there was some kind of nexus point, some kind of connection to something ethereal that people connected with, and so this spot wasn't made holy by the building or the priest. The building and or the priest and or what other holy person there was simply provided a sort of public recognition and symbol for the spirituality or the essence that was already, you know, imbuing that area.
Yeah, and it could be something as simple as earth energies that are different in that spot.
Yeah. Yeah, the, you know, sort of, you know, ley lines or telluric currents or what have you.
Yeah.
There's you know, again, you know, science is sort of still struggling with some of these ideas, but there's a lot of in any case, the way I look at it is, regardless of science, there's some good stories and interesting things to think about surrounding those ideas.
Oh, certainly. But it had always bugged me that, you know, I'd be in these newer graveyards and there'd be nothing there. I'd never had an experience, but I'd go into certain old graveyards and I'd have numerous experiences. And it's like, okay, if it's just dead people, it shouldn't matter if the graveyard's new or old.
Right.
So it's not the fact that it's a graveyard. So that leaves the location itself. What's different about the location between the new and old? And I mean, it's just a theory, it's a speculation, but it's the only one I've been able to come up with that makes that connection make any sense.
Yeah, in the same way, I kind of wonder if it's not, maybe not just old graveyards, but some old graveyards, because yes, I was back in May or June. I was in New Orleans for a conference, and I was down in the French Quarter, and I went to one of those cemeteries in New Orleans that has the sort of, you know, above ground tombs, the sort of very, you know, fancily decorated, very old above ground tombs, because, you know, if you dig 2 inches down, you're underwater in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, it doesn't feel like a graveyard. It doesn't feel like a cemetery. And I know there are probably 15,000 haunted New Orleans people out there who are going to, like, point out, you know, specific, you know, tombstones I should have licked or something to get that sort of feeling. But I didn't go on a tour or anything. I just sort of wandered in. And I remember thinking that it was an example of the sort of atemporality or things being or looking out of place in time, or different time periods overlapping. And I got that sense incredibly, but it wasn't the same sort of weird sense I've gotten from some old cemeteries. And what was very strange is you walk into the cemetery off one of the streets in the French Quarter, one of the very touristy areas, and if you leave the cemetery via, I think, a different entrance, what you find is that you are in a very sort of rundown residential neighborhood. And it's almost like, I mean, I'm not meaning this literally, but this graveyard is sort of a passage from one type of New Orleans to another type of New Orleans. So the graveyard itself existing in kind of a liminal border space between these two worlds.
Interesting. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in 45 seconds with Aaron Gullius.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And indeed, if you have any questions for Aaron, you can go into the chat room and I will pass them along. And that is wheredidtheroadgo.com. And we are talking with Aaron Gullius, whose latest book, The Chaos Conundrum, is available through through Red Star Books, which is Paul Kimball's books publisher, right?
Yes.
And it's, as we said earlier, it's not a super long read, but it's also very reasonably priced for the size.
Yeah, it's around about, you know, sort of a measly $10. It's two vanilla lattes or such something from Starbucks. So if you can forego two of those and pick up this book, that would be really, really sort of a dynamite holiday season present for me.
And
wonderful.
It is available on Amazon, right?
Yes, on Amazon, and there is Kindle version forthcoming shortly. We're not sure exactly when that's going to drop, but there is an ebook version coming soon. Yes.
Okay. And now your first book was on contactees, and you mentioned, you touch on that briefly in this book. And one of the things that that I was curious about is you mentioned different contactees, and then you mentioned Antonio Villas Boas, who I never took as a contactee.
He's you know, nobody else does either. Interestingly, about 3 days ago, my sister emailed me a link to a story from NPR where there was an NPR story talking about the Antonio Villas Boas case, and they referred to him as an abductee because he was taken on board a ship, and he was I don't know, affected sensually by a supposedly extraterrestrial woman. But one thing about the Antonio Villas Boas story that I sort of place him in the contactee camp. I think he can comfortably straddle the line, but the contactee aspect of it to me is that he was meeting with somebody who was distinctively humanoid rather than a gray, sort of the classic abductee style alien. What's missing from the Antonio Villas Boas account is some sort of overarching social, political, economic, cultural message, which was sort of part and parcel of the contactee movement from the beginning up until up until today. But it's a very strange story, because even at that early time, back in the 50s and the 60s, when the story hits the United States via one of the books by Jim and Coral Lorenzen, who ran the APRO UFO investigation outfit, people were already imprinting the extraterrestrial idea on this story. There's very little within the story to indicate that, yes, this was an alien from space. The woman sort of points upward, which everybody said, well, she's pointing to space, therefore she's an alien. I know Mac Tony sort of liked to toy around with this story being a good example of his crypto-terrestrial hypothesis, where this person was just a little too human. The alien, supposed alien, was a little too human. And importantly, I mean, crucially, she was apparently sexually or genetically compatible with this South American farmer fellow. The odds that, like we said before, that life is going to be recognizable from another planet are remote. I mean, I think it's almost infinitesimally remote that the chances are that they're going to be, you know, reproductively compatible with us, even at a sort of surface level, you know, as far as, you know, just being able to even pretend to be. I'm waving my hands embarrassedly right now, trying to come up with a way to say this, but, you know, just the idea that somebody from space would be enough like us to engage in sexual behavior with us is extremely unlikely. Unless it's some sort of Star Trek thing where we're all seeded from the same alien race. You know,
that's what I was going to say. Or you take the alien, the ancient alien idea into account. Do you want to tell people who are probably, I'm guessing a lot of people aren't fully aware of what the contactee thing is versus the abduction phenomena that happens now?
Yeah. The contactees are a sort of collective name for people from the 1950s and 60s especially, who claimed to have had face-to-face or channeled telepathic encounters with aliens from other planets. And you know, significantly, these encounters were with aliens who were physically human in appearance, generally very good-looking humans who with blonde hair and blue eyes and almost a very Aryan look. And generally, there was some sort of message of social reform, political reform, economic reform in these contacts, beginning with George Adamski from California, who was the first of that phase of contactees. He had photographs of the flying saucers and things like that. And he said that the Space Brothers, which was what he called them, wanted us to move beyond our violent natures, move beyond this dangerous atomic bomb, and you know, evolve socially to the point where we're like the peace-loving Space Brothers themselves, and they're here to coach us and to teach us through this period of maturing. Most historians who have looked at the contactees at all, which isn't very many, have dismissed them, and a lot of UFO people have dismissed them as being their stories simply being a reaction to the Cold War, sort of a fear reaction. Oh my gosh, things are going to blow up. You know, let's talk about nice things and maybe we can make all this go away. I argue in my first book and in my graduate work before that, my master's thesis is where I first sort of started talking about this thing. My idea, my argument is that the contactees represent, rather than simply a sort of knee-jerk fear reaction to the nuclear age, they represent a subculture or countercultural almost protest movement, protesting about very real, significant political and social problems in a way that wouldn't get them too much negative attention because from the powers that be, although they did receive some attention from the FBI and so forth. Because if you're talking about getting rid of private property in the 1950s, you're going to get hauled in front of somewhere and accused of being a communist.
Right.
So if you say, well, the Space Brothers told me that on Venus, this is how they do things, you just sound crazy. So you're able to get your message out to the people who you think want to hear the message and perhaps, you know, get those ideas and those memes implanted in the culture that way. I mean, it wasn't wasn't very successful. And when reports and investigations came back, it demonstrating very clearly that these contactees had lied about their credentials and lied about their photographs and you know, were discovered to have been hoaxing photographs, they lost all credibility on the flying saucer side of things, which unfortunately also robbed them of credibility on the path of giving advice and instruction for how to make the world a better place in a terrestrial sense. So, and this would go on into sort of blend in with a lot of New Age thinking in the 1970s. And in the 1990s and 21st century, I think there are aspects of the exopolitics movement that are very much in tune with the contactees as far as using these stories of alien intrigues and alien visitations to push and to promote certain social and cultural and political agendas that might not be heard otherwise. And I have a chapter about the exopolitics in the Chaos Conundrum where I sort of go into that a bit.
Yeah. That's why I didn't think Antonio quite fit, because he didn't have that sort of message. He was just freaked out about what happened to him, which to me puts him more in the line of a Whitley Strieber, who was freaked out about what happened to him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree. I think there's an excellent case to be made for it being in the abduction camp. The human nature of it and the idea that it was sexual rather than strictly a medical sort of thing is what sort of it's sort of I don't know if I want to say a transition point, but a transition point between the contactee stories and the more sort of exploitative abduction experiences. The contactees weren't generally harmed. They saw these experiences as overwhelmingly positive. And although there are some abductees who have portrayed their experiences as positive, many of them, in the sort of the connotation of it, the abductions, the very word abduction connotes something negative. Nobody enjoys getting kidnapped, right?
Some people might.
Nobody we want to know would enjoy being kidnapped. You know, at best, you might end up with a sort of Stockholm syndrome, I was going to say maybe some of these positive abductees have experienced alien Stockholm syndrome, but I think, you know, if you look at it, what we see is that people who portray their abduction experiences positively have usually been deep regression hypnotized by somebody who asserts that the aliens are beneficent. Mm. And people who have negative experiences tended to have been to people who believe these things to be sinister, like, you know, David Jacobs books, for example.
Right.
So, you know, it's a different sort of experience, and I think V.S. Boas sort of blurs the line between them. I would sort of argue he's almost his own category in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I guess so. The way I look at this, like, I think Whitley Strieber is a great example where he initially was terrified by what was happening to him, but the longer it went on, and I don't think it was a Stockholm syndrome, that he realized these may not be as negative as they initially appeared. And I also like where, like, Graham Hancock will take and show the similarities between that and shamanistic encounters,
right,
which are initially horrifying but eventually teach the shaman about himself and the way interactions in the larger scope work.
Yeah, I agree. I think Strieber's case is incredibly fascinating because from the 1980s through today, there's been such a remarkable progression of his thinking on these things.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with everything he says, but he's always worth listening to, even when I think he's being, you know, particularly and willfully odd about these things. I think he's always worth listening to because his story does evolve. And if it is, and I don't think it is, but if it is sort of I don't like the word hoax, but if it is a sort of fictional or metaphysical exploration rather than a descriptions of literal events, I think he's done a good job of developing that story over the years. And if it's a real set of experiences, I think he's been very conscious in how he's moved through these experiences and tried to gain some sort of real meaning from them beyond simply wanting to figure out what happened in a literal sense. He's looking at its meaning to him and his life in various ways that is endlessly fascinating to pay attention to.
I think if he did this story, if he made this up thinking it was going to make him rich, he made a huge, huge mistake in his life.
Yeah, because if he wanted to write stories and get rich, then his horror novels and his suspense novels were doing just fine.
Yeah.
This was not, if it was a money-making move, like you say, it was a terrible one.
Yeah.
Because just hearing his interview with Art Bell on Art Bell's most recent incarnation of his show, goes into some interesting detail about just what this did to his career. And it's not pleasant, right? It's just...
Not just his career, but his entire life. I don't know if it was on Art Bell or if it was on a recent Coast to Coast, but he was talking about how he really hasn't made any new friends since early on when this started because he can't trust people.
Right. Right. It's affected him in almost every way you can imagine. And, without knowing for sure one way or the other, I think it's very clear that something happened to Whitley Strieber.
Yes.
Something. Something very strange and something very disturbing. Whether it's something that's deeply neurologically disturbing or spiritually disturbing or extraterrestrially concerning, I think it's very clear that this is the result of some sort of experience.
And I think that if you said that to him, he would agree with you. He wouldn't want to nail it down, and he never has. And that's one of the things that's gotten him kind of blackballed from some of the UFO communities, is that he wouldn't just stick to, these are extraterrestrial aliens coming in.
Right, right. And to be honest, the extant UFO mainstream community wants the same stories told in the same way over and over. They're like X-Men comics fans, this new writer and artist, this isn't like the X-Men was when I started reading, so this sucks, right? So ufology is a fandom. It's a fandom community, and a lot of the same parallels between ufologists and ufology buffs and comic book fans or Star Trek fans or Doctor Who fans or this odd phenomenon of grown men enjoying My Little Pony or whatever.
Yes, the brony phenomenon.
The bronies, yeah. I'm deeply troubled by this. But, it's a fandom with that kind of culture, complete with little sort of hazing tests to prove that you're really one of them and that you know enough, you're knowledgeable enough to get into a conversation. Well, you haven't read all the Project Blue Book reports, and you haven't read this book and that book, and you haven't seen this documentary. Well, how dare you even talk about this? And I think what that's done is it's sort of scared off a lot of people who are curious and a lot of people who have interesting things to say about it. But luckily, the internet has made it easier for people like that to get together on their own terms.
True. True. And we mentioned this earlier, I mentioned this name earlier. Well, Bill Cooper. You want to get into a little bit about him and the MJ-12 stuff?
Yeah. Bill Cooper was a master at taking other people's work, presenting it as his own, debunking it, and then running away. which is sort of how I see the UFO side of his career. He sort of appears on bulletin board systems in the late 1980s, talking about how when he was in the Navy, he was assigned to the commander of the Pacific Fleet's briefing team, I think is what it was. And in the course of this job, he saw some documents, and he presented these documents and the secret, the origin and purpose of MJ-12 and this secret organization, cabal of people whose existence had been hinted at by some supposedly classified documents leaked to Bill Moore and Stanton Friedman and Jamie Chandra, back in the 80s. And Cooper jumps onto this and says, yes, this is true, because it matches up with what I saw in the Navy. And what I saw in the Navy was blah, 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 blah. And then by the early 90s, it became clear that blah, 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 and blah had actually been circulating in various documents around the community for a very long time, at least, you know, 10, 15 years or so. And so when Cooper is sort of confronted with these things, he says, yes, I was, you know, I was presented with disinformation in the Navy as part of an ongoing campaign to, you know, disinform the public about what's going on. And then he shifted his pitch ever slightly to be UFOs and the alien abduction thing and the secret government talk are all disinformation designed to lure it, like lean us away from the truth. And the truth is there is a new world order, one world government sort of thing, sort of standard anti-government conspiracy, right-wing conspiracy theory stuff from the 80s and 90s. And he moves into that direction. And he goes on to be one of the leaders of something he called the Second Continental Army of the Republic, which was basically one of these militia groups from back in the 90s. And he had a shortwave radio show, and he transitioned from being this UFO figure to being this right-wing militia figure. And it's very hard to find the point when he switches. But at some point, he just completely became on a different track to these things. And he's fascinating because he's so angry. He's dead now, but he's so angry and so passionate. And his radio show, he's a good speaker. You can get the MP3s for all of these things out there now. And he's a good speaker and he's a good host. And, you know, a lot of what he's saying is just plain paranoia. And most of what he's saying was said by other people before. But he had this platform and he sampled it and remixed it. And he presented it as his own, as his own research, as he called it. And he was just a master of getting people to believe him. And if you go and Google Bill Cooper now, what you will find on forums like Above Top Secret and all the other, you know, UFO and paranormal and conspiracy forums, all the newbies come up and they say, hey, I found this stuff by Bill Cooper. Because, you know, it's the internet. Things exist outside of time on the internet. If it's there, it must be current, even if the date on the file is 1991, right? But it just came up on Google, so it must be a new thing, or at least a current thing. And so the past is being, it's not like old trends are coming back again. That's sort of an old-fashioned way to look at it. There are no trends. Everything is always here all the time. And you can pick and choose who your authorities are and what you decide evidence is, which really, in a way, sums up the paranormal and devotees of the paranormal. You get on your hobby horse, you ride it till it drops, then you shoot it and eat it for food. You know, you just stay on that thing no matter what, whether it's Roswell or abductions or the secret government or the New World Order. Any changes in the way the world works that come your way, you simply rework your theory to include them, and or rework them to fit your theory, and then you just keep on moving.
Well, do you think that the contactees, do you think any of them actually had any real paranormal experiences, or do you think that they all just fictionalized this to push their belief systems?
Oh man, cop out answer time. I wouldn't be surprised if some of them did experience actual things. I say that because there are some stories that include some genuine weirdness, especially the channeled messages, the sort of psychically channeled messages, not the I physically went on a flying saucer, but some of the psychically channeled stuff. You and your listeners might be familiar with the name Albert K. Bender.
Yes, vaguely.
Vaguely. He was one of the progenitors of the Men in Black myth.
Oh, right, right. Okay.
Which was largely the product of Gray Barker, who wrote They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers back in the 1950s. But that book was about Albert Bender, who ran the International Flying Saucer Bureau and was warned off. He claims to have discovered the secret of the saucers and then is warned off by three men in black, who at first are in the Gray Barker book initially are you know, we don't know what they are. Are they government agents? Are they the FBI? Are they the CIA? Are they foreign intelligence officers? Are they aliens? Are they clerical people? Some people are all black, maybe clerical garb. You know, the Vatican's trying to shut up the sure. sausage searchers. But Barker very much leaves this open. And if you have a chance, and if your listeners have a chance, find a copy of They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers by Gray Barker. It is one of the most fun, well-written books about the subject ever. And his book, The Silver Bridge, is a very different take on the Mothman thing than John Keel had. It's a very interesting take. But Bender, when he wrote his own book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men in the early 1960s, he describes the three men as aliens from the planet, I think it was pronounced Kaik. It was K-A-Z-I-K, but pronounced Kaik, sort of a weird alien sort of sound, who took him to a flying saucer in a base in Antarctica and some very strange stuff. But Bender had some interesting psychological issues. Nick Redfern, in his book about the contactees, goes into what he sees as possibly some kind of repressed sexual problems that Bender might have had, and obsessions with horror movie imagery that might have worked on his brain to such a point where he did maybe conjure things that suggested these sorts of men in black. So I think some of them probably did have some real experiences, and some of them simply saw a way to sell books and tickets to speaking engagements and conventions and came up with a story that was enough like what people wanted to hear that they accepted it, but different enough that they could market themselves as a unique thing. So there's some very savvy salesmanship there too.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. But I definitely have to have you back. There's a bunch of other stuff I wanted to get to.
Absolutely.
And, your new book, again, is The Chaos Conundrum. We've been talking with Aaron Gullius, and this is subtitled Essays on UFOs, Ghosts, and Other High Strangers in Our Non-Rational and Atemporal World. It's only in print right now. It's only $10. But you will have the digital version up soon.
Yes, soonish. Soonish.
As far as I know. Where can people find more websites and stuff like that?
Yeah, my main sort of home is at ajgulyas.com. ajgulyas.com. And I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/AaronJohnGullius. That's it's spelled like it is on your website, and there's a link right there.
There is?
I think so.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, there is. Okay.
That was confirming.
Yes. I'm on Twitter as Furcon, at Furcon, F-I-R-K-O-N, which is actually the name of one of George Adamski's friends from Venus. I chose that for my Twitter handle back in the day. Those Facebook, the web, and on Twitter, that's where they can find me and information about stuff I've done and stuff that's coming up in the future.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for talking to us tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
And next week we have Mike Cloughand, who's going to be talking to us a little bit about his own UFO experiences and the connection between owls and UFO abductees. So that's next week on Where'd the Road Go? Now some Psyche Corporation to take you out.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. reason to be wary. You are getting to the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atria, chambers numbered 1597 and counting. And counting. Can you?